Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody joining us. We have got, I think, the most chock full episode of knowledge and experience and just information for you this time around. And I can't wait to get into it. So we're going to jump into it right away. And of course, that means we've got to lead into my co-host, Sam Bradley. Sam, you've lined up an amazing group of guests for tonight.
Well, I can't take all the credit for that because basically this started as our friend Kevin Ryder's idea. He's here often as a co-host with us. He came up with the idea based on an article he found, and that led to this guy and then to this guy. And we've actually captured the author of said article, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. So, you know, I don't know that we talked a whole bunch about Kevin and what he does, but he's a real outdoor enthusiast. He was actually a reconnaissance specialist in the U.S. military. I don't know how many people know that, but we basically know him as the dive master, the master scuba diver, and the dive medical technician, which few people can aspire to. He's done search and rescue, and he's a volunteer EMT and firefighter. And the reason I'm focusing a little bit on Kevin tonight is he's going to carry most of this podcast because I know that we not only have a thunderstorm outside, but I have guys beating on my roof. So it's going to get kind of noisy. So I'm going to let, since this was Kevin's idea in the first place, I'm going to let him run with it. So say hi, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
Hi, guys.
This gives you some idea. I tell you, these guys that we're going to talk to tonight are a real hoot, so I know this is going to be a really educational podcast. But first, Jamie, I don't think I've ever seen as much wild stuff going on in the news as going on right now. You want to touch on some of that?
Well, of course, a few days ago, we had a major flooding incident in West Virginia. I think the last number I saw was 26 dead. Numerous, just hundreds of homes destroyed or washed away even. Saw some incredible news footage of a house floating down a river on fire. It was the most bizarre thing I've ever seen. You know, how do you put that? You'd think the river would put it out, but it was completely engulfed in flame floating down the river. So it just devastating. And we've been talking a lot about floods in Texas, and it's now, you know, struck an area on the East Coast as well. And it just brings back, I think, you know, that we need to all be prepared because you just don't know when some of these major cells are in your region and dropping 10 inches of rain in a short period of time, anybody can be in a place where there could be a flash flood risk.
Yes, absolutely. And then there just today, I guess, Kevin, you sent me something on there's a train wreck in Texas, I guess a pretty substantial one.
Yeah, two trains collided and the plume of smoke was seen from miles away. And it was a pretty big thing.
And if that isn't weird enough, we actually had lightning strike a paramedic unit and injure both the medic and the EMT in Kentucky. So, I mean, it doesn't get much weirder than that. So, I don't know. We can't spend a lot of time on each of these stories, but keep your eyes open out there because there's a lot of strange stuff going on. So I want to say hi to the Sasquatch, and we call him that because it's hard to catch this guy, and we drag him in here, you know, every couple of months. So we want to say hi to Jim Logan in Memphis. Say hi, Jim.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Kevin. Hi, Jim. How's that work? Yeah,
that
so,
worked.
So man, it's so glad that I missed you guys a lot. So busy here in Memphis. Had a really great summer so far. Looking forward to this episode.
Excellent. This is going to be a great episode. And Dr. Joe Hawley, our almost every episode guest and, of course, part of our sponsorship with Paragon. Say hi, Joe.
Hey, guys. Good to be here.
Glad you're here with us. So I'm going to just run through everybody else real quick, and then, of course, we're going to spend some time talking to them. David Pfeiffer, you're from Kentucky.
That's correct. Currently talking to you from Richmond, Kentucky.
Well, tell us just a quick bit about yourself and what you do.
Well, full-time, I'm a lecturer in emergency medical care at Eastern Kentucky University. We're one of the few baccalaureate paramedic programs. And I'm the coordinator of the Red Star Wilderness Response Unit in the Red River Gorge here in Kentucky. We are the backcountry response unit of Powell County EMS.
And we're going to have links, of course, to all of these guys and their wonderful sites that you probably are going to want to go and get more information from. Dr. Seth Hawkins, he's been a guest before. We love him to death, and we got him back for this episode because it's very much wilderness medicine-based, and he's one of the experts. Tell him about yourself, Seth.
Hey, everyone. Yeah, big fan and happy to be on the show again. I'm an emergency physician in North Carolina, board certified in EMS, and I specialize in wilderness medicine. I founded the Carolina Wilderness EMS externship. Our first extern was a young whippersnapper named Ben Abo, and also the Appalachian Center for Wilderness Medicine, and I'm the co-founder of the Wilderness EMS Medical Director course.
Good segue. Thank you. Because we have Dr. Ben Abo with us. He's also a medic. And he happens to be the author of the article to which we will refer. And we call him the Banana Man for reasons we may or may not get into. We got the Sasquatch and the Banana Doc. So that's a long story. So hi, Ben.
Hi, I find it very appealing to be here and be called the Banana Man. So I appreciate it. I'm very excited to talk with y'all.
I do have to say one more thing before we jump in, and I don't know how many of you actually know this, but most of you know that our Jamie Davis is an author. He has written an entire series. It's actually still in progress. Very interesting series, combining medicine and the paranormal, paramedicine and the paranormal, you might say. And he got on BookBub, which for those of us that are involved in this, really is a good way of getting information out there. Today alone, he sold about 3,000 books just through that. He now has a little orange ribbon under his first book, which lets everyone know he's a number one best-selling author on Amazon. So we're very, very proud of him, and we're anxious to see how this works out in the next few days. So had to say that.
Thank you, Sam. I do appreciate that. But check out my books if you want to. Take them for what they are. They're a lot of fun to write, and hopefully they're a lot of fun to read.
They are. They're a lot of fun to read. Trust me, I read them all. All right, let's jump into this. We're talking about an article that was written by Dr. Ben Abo for Jim's called Wilderness Medicine Considerations for the Urban Medic. And we thought this was just a great topic that we haven't. We've talked a lot about wilderness medicine kind of here and there and everywhere, but never really translated the differences so much. And that's something that we're going to do tonight. So Kevin's actually worked up some questions primarily for Ben, but certainly we want all of our other experts to jump in with comments, and certainly Jim and Joe to the extent that they have questions. Yes, and thank you for reminding me of that, Jamie. We are going to do something different with this broadcast. We were actually able to find a means of giving some continuing education to those involved with the Wilderness Medical Associates. So, Seth, I'm going to let you explain how that's going to work.
Yeah, so really briefly, the Wilderness Medical Society established a fellowship in their Academy of Wilderness Medicine, which grants a fellow degree. So people put after their name FAWM for fellow in the Academy of Wilderness Medicine. And that's a well-established activity for physicians. But the really cool thing about this is that it extends to any healthcare provider who's doing work in a wilderness environment. So nurses and paramedics and really anybody with healthcare credentials is eligible to become an applicant for and then obtain this fellowship. So it's granted via credit. So we're hoping tonight to grant credits to people who are fellowship applicants. I'm actually a master fellow, and Kevin and David are fellow applicants, and Ben Abo is a newly minted or about to be newly minted fellow himself. So a lot of us have experience in this, and the credits accumulate to grant you the fellowship. So tonight we will be hopefully filing this as a fellow eligible CME activity. And in order to do that, we will be embedding some secret code words throughout the presentation that we will announce, and you can mail to the Wilderness Medical Society via email to get credit for having listened to the podcast. We'll mention it again at the end, but the email to use for that purpose would be terry@wms.org. So just be listening through the podcast for the fellowship code word that will help you get credit for this presentation.
Yes, and we're very excited to be able to do that for you guys because it's something brand new, and hopefully that'll bring us in a few more new listeners. So it's definitely a win-win for everybody. Okay, Kevin, I'm going to toss this to you, and I hope you have your questions warmed up and ready, and let's just jump into it. I'll be in the background here with Jamie, paying attention to what's going on and enjoying this podcast.
Cool. So thanks, everyone, for joining tonight. Hopefully this will be an awesome episode. But Dr. Ben, what was your motivation for writing this article?
Well, it kind of comes down to when I was talking to another former EMS fellow and wilderness guru who I originally met, who took the Wilderness EMS Medical Doctors course. And we were talking about some of the different things because he's a rural physician, William Saudi, who co-wrote this article with me. And his experience in EMS and wilderness medicine domestically is very different from mine, being on the disaster team, doing international NGO work, as well as I'm an urban paramedic physician working with City of Miami, Miami-Dade Fire Rescue, Hallandale Beach, Miami Beach, and all. And down here in Florida, you know, we're very attuned to natural disasters, hurricanes and all. And I talk all the time with my medics and firefighters and co-physicians and nurses about, you know, what to do, what we do to prepare. And they talk about having this tool and that tool, and a lot of things where really they have to start to learn that denial is not just a river in Egypt. You know, these natural disasters and things happen even in urban settings, and we know that. Hurricanes happen in Miami and can easily wipe things out there, where and an urban setting can easily become an austere setting. And so having these skills in wilderness medicine is not just, oh, if you're doing an expedition or you're on a family trip in Belize, something happens. It's more of a, this can happen here. We need education. We need to be ready for things because we don't plan on accidents. We don't plan on disasters, although maybe we should. We know it's going to happen.
Awesome. So in your article, you go into different considerations. You discuss when to initiate rescue, what types of scenarios or situations you would consider evacuating somebody without further thought. And then you go into different ways of packaging the patient. And you mentioned a rope stretcher. So for those people who have never heard about one or seen one, can you describe what a rope stretcher is?
Right. So with regards to the rope stretcher, and a lot of this, I should also kind of step back and say that the other part of this article is kind of a first part, an introduction to wilderness medicine for the urban medics, that they kind of start to understand some of these practices, as well as I'm definitely one that's more of a black cloud for these sort of things, but we can be on vacation and things happen. So these urban medics can be out there and need to help people, just like when you're on a flight and something happens. So you might need to do these kind of different things where people look at you, oh, you're a firefighter, oh, you're a paramedic, oh, you're an EMT. They expect you to have these still similar skill sets that we don't use all the time. And we're not paid for what we do. We're paid for what we're prepared to do. So we should prepare more. With respect to the rope stretcher, we talked about... Sorry. We talk about all the time when I do different wilderness medicine interest group stuff or the different medical schools here in Florida, we talk about some of the cool things and making this rope stretcher and what can you use to make a stretcher if you had to evacuate someone out and do different things. Of course, it's better to have them fix and walk out themselves if someone's hurt in any situation. But if you need to, you can make this rope stretcher, which basically is if you take a long piece of rope and you go back and forth so it zigzags, and then you could put either a stick or poles down either side or even just pick it up or even put more rope around the borders, but it creates a cot or a stretcher that a patient can lay on. And when we talk about it within the article, and the way it's usually practiced, because it's fun and it's cool and we do these things in the wilderness medicine classes, it's very restricting because you're layering them with blankets and sleeping bags and doing different things. But with the ropes that go back and forth underneath and then on top, you really lose access to your patient. That's one of the things that we refer to there with patient packaging.
Awesome. So obviously, if someone is going to be doing this, they want to have some rope in their kit. Do you have any suggestions on some general items that somebody might want to have with them if they were to get in any kind of situation that becomes a backcountry or wilderness setting, such as a natural disaster or an extended outing in the woods or wilderness? Nothing too specific, but like a general overall...
Overall, all the suggestions really are come down to it really depends. It depends if we're talking about how should you prepare it at home. What's, you know, for instance, I live in Miami. What's in my go bag? When it's hurricane season, I have a bin I take out, and there's certain things that I have. If I'm responding, I'm going hiking in certain areas, what I have and carry is different than when I'm backpacking and I'm the medical chaperone when I'm backpacking in Africa providing medical care. For the most part, a lot of these calls or types of patients are trauma-related or simple GI bugs and dehydration. So obviously water filtration is very important. A way to signal and communicate is very important. And basic trauma care, even a simple tourniquet, which is much easier to carry than a whole lot of bandaging and tape. And then when you talk about things like the rope stretcher and all, you need a significant amount of rope. Am I carrying all this rope all the time? Absolutely not. Am I carrying it off an ambulance out for every single call? No. It kind of depends on what's going on and what the type of call would be or what kind of the expedition is. But for the most part, think dehydration, think what you can do, MacGyver medicine to make a good splint. And bleeding control for basic trauma care.
So I'm going to jump in here before Kevin gets with the next question. And this is our first keyword for the CME credit. So get ready to write this down. You're going to look at your screen on your podcast player, note the time code, and we'll have that noted as well to Terry over at the Wilderness Medicine Society. And the keyword is rope stretcher. So that's the keyword, rope stretcher. And look at your screen right now on your player and then note down what time it is on there for the time played so far in this episode. And we'll go ahead and get back into the episode.
So, Ben, what do you think the biggest challenge is, the biggest challenge in the back for backcountry medicine?
I'd say the biggest challenge in backcountry medicine, similar for wilderness medicine or disaster medicine, comes down to, something I often quote myself saying, and I already mentioned before, is number one, realizing that denial is not just forever in Egypt. Something can happen. Things happen to skilled people. Things happen to backcountry people. Things happen to urban people. So just understand that things can happen. You don't have to be a worry and wrap yourself in bubble wrap no matter what. But you need to not have denial that things can happen. The other thing is just training. How do you decide what you should practice? How do you decide what equipment to have or what training to do? So a lot of that just comes down to realizing and thinking ahead and thinking of the different possibilities.
Hey, Ben, let me throw a question in here because we're kind of talking about this on the side. I know a lot of people don't know the answer to this, nor can I say I do, and maybe there isn't a difference. But when you talk about backcountry, how is that different from wilderness medicine, or is there a difference?
For the most part, I'd say the difference between backcountry medicine and wilderness medicine is spelling. That's really it. When, you know, and this also brings up what even got me initially into wilderness medicine and all. Wilderness medicine, austere medicine, disaster medicine, backcountry medicine, basically is any episode where something's going, you have a patient or patients, then they can be, anywhere from one patient to hundreds of patients. But basically your geography or resources really are lacking. Maybe it takes too long to get to definitive care. Maybe you don't have the means to transport someone to there. Maybe you don't have the means to communicate to get help to there. So really, it's this austere environment where you lack the resources to really care for what's needed, especially compared to, you know, you're in downtown Gainesville, you call 911 because you're having chest pain. You don't have the same resources in the middle of Linville Gorge or the Grand Canyon or Africa.
Hey, this is Seth Hawkins. I might weigh in here as well with a thought. In our system, for our special operations team, we have the Jimmy Winters principle. So Jimmy Winters is a captain in our system, and his message to one of my externs as they described an especially intricate plan for extricating a patient was, well, you said that easy. And I think a lot of times urban rescuers may have concepts of how things might work in the wilderness, and I'll bet David has lived through this many times. Things get very complicated in the woods and in alpine environments for things that you don't expect. So a lot of plans that seem very simple become very complicated just by basic environmental factors like wearing a lot of clothing and gear or not having much space to work in or the sun going away. I think that's something that's pretty pervasive in EMS, where hospital-based providers often don't understand how difficult things can be in EMS simply because of the circumstances of the environment. And that's exacerbated even more in the wilderness setting. So, you know, running an operation in New Hampshire in January, about an hour away from the road, is exceptionally difficult in ways that's really hard to train by scenario or to describe to anyone. They really have to live it. So I would echo what Ben's saying about training, that actually, if you plan to do any kind of wilderness operational activities, actually getting out there and experiencing the environment you'll be working in is quite sobering for you know, the challenges that can come up just operationally.
Oh, definitely. And yeah. I think another thing to add too, if I can jump in real quick, some basic outdoor skill sets, I think, are a must. If you have a patient and it's cold outside and you need to spend the night and you need to keep them warm, if you don't know how to build a shelter or start a fire, those two play a key element in patient care that I think get overlooked a lot.
Yeah, I would agree with both of that. And I think touching on what Seth said in particular, the Red River Gorge, where I operate in Kentucky, is a very popular outdoor recreation spot. So it has been developed somewhat. There's paved roads, and there's packed gravel roads, and there's bathrooms at the trailheads. And it's friendly. It's a friendly place for families to come and hike. But we have a lot of pretty intense wilderness calls because of those unexpected aspects of reality. So, you know, we might be responding to a patient who's injured 2 or 3 miles from the trailhead, which is along a paved road, but we have to rig multiple steep and high angle belays to get the Stokes basket back out that we packaged the patient in. And so it becomes a extended operation of many hours requiring some prolonged field care concepts. So it kind of makes me wonder, Ben, what is your definition of wilderness? You know, some people talk about 3 hours from definitive care or such and such distance from a roadway. But when you're just a stone's throw from a roadway, but you still have to spend hours to carry the patient out, it seems like that's wilderness to me. So what are your thoughts on that?
You know, that's absolutely a great question. And, you know, we talk about time or distance or just the lack of resources. Anything can obviously change. And I go back to it but when a disaster comes through where things are blocked. I was just recently lecturing to my Miami Beach fire rescue medics, and we're talking about drowning and water-related trauma and certain things that we're starting to see more of. And I reminded them that they have all this beautiful equipment, and they run 3 on a rescue truck. And a rescue truck in South Florida is what we call an ambulance. So you run 3 paramedic firefighters on every ambulance for all these calls. But what if you can't get those people or the equipment to there for exactly those reasons? A lot of Miami-Dade County is way out there where sometimes the helicopter actually beats an ambulance when you're talking about with the Native Americans and all. And then we, as well as different keys and different things far out in the water. So there's this beautiful wilderness even right within urban settings or right nearby, as well as one of the largest urban parks is right in the middle of Miami, Olathe State Park, where we had a spinal injury in the water and you have to take care of water-related lung injuries and worry about spinal cord and you have to get them out. And it's in a shallow area where even the county fireboat, which is basically a giant jet ski that needs very little clearance, couldn't get up to where it was. So that definition of wilderness and austere medicine really is able to flex depending on your resources and how long it takes to do things. When I was doing the wilderness EMS externship with Seth, we actually had a call where someone was out in the off-road vehicle park and broke his spine, landed doing a jump on his back. And we had decided, you know, do we carry him out on the ATV, which would take time and we were losing sunlight and people would get hurt, or do we call in for NC Heart? And when we did that, and what NC Heart is basically calling in a Blackhawk or something equivalent to winch them out, because you can't just drive back there. We had to make a fire, so we had to clear the debris and make a fire and warm them up. And my medics, and for the most part me, you know, we're not used to doing that, those kinds of things. But even the urban medics might have to when a disaster or hurricane comes through, or they're out in these expeditions and all.
Ben, that's awesome. Actually kind of segues into another question which we had. But, you know, it's one thing to package the patient, which is going to be very different than it is in the urban setting. But then there is getting them out of there. And you may or may not have air resources. But to what extent are you able to use those? Are they usually available to you? Or what would be your other means of getting a patient out of there? And what kind of equipment would you use?
You know, this is some of the beauty of why I love this, and these topics and kind of things, because you really have to think on your feet. That's why I like EMS. That's why I like emergency medicine and international stuff, too, because when I'm doing this kind of stuff and I'm developing an EMS system in Ethiopia, which is a dirt bike-based ambulance, imagine a dirt bike with a sidecar as a modified ambulance for off-road, you know, you don't have all these cool rescue tools. In Miami-Dade County, we have air rescue. We have a fireboat that can get out there. And, you know, how you package them and you use these brand-type things in different baskets and all, similar to what you'd see in Coast Guard movies and all. You know, I was even on a call with the fireboat, and we had to go 4 miles out to sea to pull someone with a GI bleed off a cruise ship. And you think, oh, you just pull the boat up to the cruise ship, and, you know, that's that. No, you have to kind of package them correctly, and how do you line up the boats and deal with the flow and the waves and everything. You know, what do you want to give people? I have love handles, but you need to give patients real handles so that you can maneuver them and move them around. Where are those handles? How are you going to grab it? What are you going to use? Are the heights going to be equivalent? Do you need to carry people out? Do you need to go up an embankment, or do you just need to carry someone? And all of that comes into play with deciding what you're going to use and what you're going to need. Down in Miami-Dade and Broward, you have a lot of resources, but they'll fly a helicopter like nothing. You need it, they're there. It really doesn't take much, and they will fly through some pretty intense weather if needed also. Granted, I will say that I've never felt unsafe every time that I ride with Air Rescue. They're amazing, but they go through a lot. They put themselves through a lot to be able to get there for patients. In other places, you don't have those kinds of resources. I'm now working and just started at University of Florida up in Gainesville in Alachua County and all, and working with Shands Care, where we have critical care and trauma transport and all, but they don't have the hoisting capabilities that we have, you know, in Arizona or with NC Heart with the Blackhawks we have down in Miami-Dade. So knowing what you have or what resources are available or potentially available are extremely important. And it really is scenario based. Know what you might have or might need. If I'm doing something where I'm doing an extended trip or medical chaperone, or I even need to go and rescue one kid, and I know that there's a bunch of other kids, I'm not going to bring as many large-sized items. I might plan accordingly for that. So really, you have to stay flexible and think about what your mission is and what's going on.
And, awesome. And Ben, I have to back up here just a second because I realize I failed in my mission to introduce you properly. So why don't you just jump in and tell us a little bit more about yourself and what you do?
I appreciate that. I basically am an EMS physician or paramedic physician here in Florida. I actually graduated from residency down in Miami Beach recently and just started an EMS fellowship here at University of Florida in Gainesville. So I'll be working here as an emergency medicine attending. And I've been actually staying very active in EMS. I've been in EMS for about 19 years now, starting as an EMT in New Jersey and paramedic in Pittsburgh, and took some time off to do some international development abroad. And I've been active as well on the clinically, on top of my medical direction duties down in Miami, the Hallandale Beach Fire Rescue and all. But I'm also a physician for our DMAT team, the Disaster Medical Systems team, and also our Urban Search and Rescue team, Task Force 1 with Miami-Dade Fire Rescue. And then furthermore, on top of that, I'm one of the instructors along with Seth for the Wilderness EMS Medical Directors course.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff. And actually, you cover what I do in DMAT and what Dr. Joe does in USAR. So you're a busy guy.
Keep him busy.
I was just about to ask. Right?
What's that?
I was just about to ask Joe, what do you think the similarities are, if any, between what you do in USAR and what we're doing here?
Well, this is Joe. I think there are quite a few, you know, certainly when it comes to the sort of thinking on your feet and MacGyvering the situation together, that's not at all uncommon. And I think for USAR, it's a lot of transitions between those different scenarios that you were talking about earlier, where you go from a completely austere environment in New Orleans, for example, that, you know, has everything down and is nothing but a giant flood zone, to areas that are impacted, like Moore, Oklahoma, by a tornado, but have relatively intact surrounding infrastructure. And so you're crossing between all those different versions of various amounts of wilderness and austere environment and urban environment as just part of your daily practice. So, you know, I think it's very much the same mindset. It's very much the same set of skills and tools and very much the same kind of medicine.
You know, this is David. It's so funny that you guys mentioned this because on the Red Star unit that I coordinate here in the Red River Gorge, which is really focused on the wilderness, we recruited several members from Ohio Task Force 1 USAR team because of that overlap of skill sets. Even though it is in some sense sort of the opposite, they get into, you know, breaking and breaching concrete and WMD hazmat things, and meanwhile Red Star is about backcountry ALS, that skill set of being able to operate in an austere environment, in different temperature ranges, and having to work with basically just the gear that you're carrying on your back at the time translates directly. And that is actually translated into potential involvement of our team in Kentucky's new state USAR task force that they may be trying to form. So we see a lot of overlaps in those skill sets. And that kind of got me thinking about a question for you, Ben. Do you see value in the wilderness medicine, the sorts of scenarios that you typically learn in a wilderness medicine course? Do you see value in that for helping develop the creative thinking abilities of traditional EM residents? Do you feel like there's like some value added in the residents' training process by doing a little WOOF A course or even a WOOFer?
You know what, David? That's an absolutely beautiful question. As beautiful as that interaction, you closing that gap between Ohio and coming and joining your team there, because that over reliance on certain skill sets is often forgotten. With respect to the skill sets that come from it, I think it's a huge, huge, huge value. In fact, I started another group here called FLOMA, which is we have a Facebook group, but we're actually getting started to have the website, which is the Florida Outdoor and Wilderness Medical Association, just trying to get medical students, nurses, PAs, residents, an opportunity to get more of these skill sets that you would learn from a WOOFer or WFA or any of those things, AWLS. Some of those skill sets to learn, not only for outside stuff and doing these activities in beautiful Florida, which you can come and visit even when it's hurricane season, we've got a lot to do, but I do think it translates into the ED. There's a lot of things where I can think on the fly, and you know, this machine's down, or I don't have that tool. You need to think differently. You have to think outside the box. It's very easy for me to think outside the box because I just don't get in the box. I take all these wilderness medicine stuff. I do these different skill sets so I can stay outside the box, and I'm ready for different things. I'm very excited. I recently was talking just 2 days ago with a lot of the new residents here at University of Florida that are very interested in wilderness medicine, have done different Wilfer stuff. And I already see it just in their conversations when we talk about different cases within the ER. Their ways of thinking are completely different than my junior residents that I worked with down in Miami Beach. So there are definitely skills and thought processes that translate over and are very beneficial to the, you know, lack of better words, traditional medical education.
And I'm going to jump in again because it's time for another one of our Con Ed keywords. So get ready here, folks. You're going to write down USAR. USAR is our keyword, USAR. And you're going to look at your screen and on your player. Go ahead and check out what time it is on there, how the time elapsed for this episode is so far. And that'll be what you turn in with this keyword, along with our first keyword, which you already have written down. And we'll go ahead and make sure we get you that CME credit so far.
Hey, I could jump in here. It's Seth Hawkins again, just to bounce off a couple threads that I think deserve to be expanded. We had mentioned earlier the importance of familiarity with wilderness environments and how just basic backcountry skills are pretty critical, and I definitely think that that's true. Really, one of the hallmarks of those skill sets, as well as wilderness medicine, is improvisation. And I think that that may be the heart and soul of wilderness medicine, and it becomes a little bit diluted in wilderness EMS because we become accustomed to having certain tools available that we plan to bring in to the environment. And that's in the micro level, like having an IV or having even like orientation equipment. Like there's a longstanding debate in the outdoors community about whether GPS units are the best thing since sliced bread because they solve so many problems, or if they're actually creating an entire generation of outdoors enthusiasts who can't use a map and compass. So really, I think one of the important lessons on a micro level, just like Ben was saying, is not even anticipating a box. Like you may have your hand tied behind your back and one eye is blinded by the tick that embedded in it, and you still have to take care of that patient. And so learning how to use multiple tools in multiple ways is a big part of this. Many of us, when we think about patient care, we think about building a kit. We think about multiple uses for anything that we have. And I think the rope litter that rope stretcher that we discussed earlier is a great example of that. And then in a macro sense, you know, here in the Southeast, there are no Mountain Rescue Association endorsed teams. The furthest one to the west is Phoenix, and the furthest one to the north is Pittsburgh. So Mountain Rescue Association teams, which are much more common in New England and out west, train personnel to do ground-up climbing rescues and to have EMS personnel who are duly qualified as climbers and as EMS personnel. Here in my specific operational region, we've become very reliant on the Black Hawk helicopters that Ben describes, which is great. Like having that asset is huge, but they will not always be available. They'll sometimes be deployed. The weather will sometimes not be cooperative. Sometimes they'll be too long to deploy locally and here domestically. And so really having other options is really, really important. And so we're working here with the Appalachian Mountain Rescue Team to build a Mountain Rescue Association endorsed team in the Southeast. And I think that's an example of being facile and having lots of arrows in the quiver so that you can attack the problem multiple ways when your first or second or third option fails, your batteries run out, you drop your super cool portable ultrasound in the water, and you still have a patient who needs to be cared for.
Or you just have a Foley catheter.
Amen. I was going to get to that, but Ben, I think you had a follow-up on what he's talking about.
Yeah, right along with Seth is talking about, and that actually still goes back to even just the educational concepts that David was referring to, but we become very reliant, whether you're pre-hospital, you're first responder wilderness, you're in the hospital, with equipment and things. When you talk to juniors and colleagues all the time, when I talk to colleagues and juniors all the time, it's like, well, what would you do in this case? And give them a scenario, or we have a scenario right in front of us, like, oh, well, I'm going to use the GlideScope, or I'll use this. So I know my junior residents, and I say to them, oh, you like the Mac Blade? Well, boom, I take it away. I knew a junior resident was very used to using the GlideScope, and they would use it no matter what. So I put a piece of tape over it, and they didn't know how to problem solve and figure out why is that. They didn't even know that there's tape on there. They just were at a loss and couldn't think outside the box there. And it's same as if your piece of equipment that you're relying on doesn't work. You can say, and I've had paramedics, my urban medics, that have said to me, oh, well, you know, I'll put them on the monitor and the BP cuff that automatically will take, and I'll set it for every 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever. And it doesn't matter how bundled up they are because I don't need to get right back to them. And then I said, okay, well, what if one of the leads comes off? What, you know, how do you put monitor leads on someone who's wet? Which, you know, is something that we recently overcame. One of my medic firefighters for Miami-Dade on the fireboat found this awesome thing with basically these little suction cups, and they work great for electrodes when someone's wet, even a little bit damp. But you can't just rely on this equipment and talk about it. How do you let patients void if you're carrying them out or you're keeping them bundled up? How do you monitor their urinary output? How do you do different things when you drop that equipment or something breaks or, oops, I left it in the truck, which is, you know, 5 miles back? Having those different means and the abilities to not have to rely on such big equipment is very important. And similar to everything with backcountry, and I'm sure David can attest to, because what you use, you're carrying. What you need, you carry. Am I correct, David?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the biggest challenges I think that we face in the search and rescue and wilderness medicine environment that we're in here, and I think that this probably is the same for other places, is that the nature of these settings is characterized by a lot of times poor communications infrastructure. A lot of times you have initial responders who are Good Samaritans, fellow recreators, for example, who don't really have a lot of medical training. So you get really spotty dispatch information, even more so than sometimes occurs in the front country environment with just third-party callers. And I think a lot of people have experienced that. But, you know, you'll get a call for subject has fallen here. And is that a child? Is that a very large adult? How far did they fall? Is it just a broken leg, or is it a 200 footer off a cliff and it's going to be multi-system trauma? And so we're limited to what we're carrying on our back, just like Ben said. And sometimes what you're carrying is not correct for that call. So that's where you really have to know how to think outside the box and improvise, and maybe turn to traditional wilderness medicine concepts of using the patient's own gear to improvise things like splints and carrying devices and stuff like that.
And that's going to wrap up this particular episode of the Disaster Podcast. It's part one of a two-part episode that will conclude next week. And as I said earlier in the show, or was mentioned earlier in the show, we will have continuing education credit for those who are seeking a WMS fellowship. So if you're looking for that Wilderness Medicine Society fellowship, you can go ahead and follow the keywords that you have already in this episode with the keywords and timestamps in the second episode to come out next week. You'll find that there. I want to make a special thank you to our sponsors, as always, Paragon Medical Education Group. The folks over there, Jim, Joe, and the rest of the gang at Paragon, do a fantastic job of educating jurisdictions, fire departments, EMS services, health departments, hospitals, and others all about what they need to do to be better prepared for that once-in-a-career disaster situation that comes along, whether it's an active shooter incident, a tornado, all kinds of things. Their experience in the USAR arena and in the disaster management arena is second to none, and they bring that experience to you in their experiential training programs. You can find out more about them over at ParagonMedicalGroup.com. You can also check out their Twitter feed at ParagonMedEDU, and you can always check out their link over at disasterpodcast.com. But follow up with them, check out and find out how you can bring them into your service to improve and really take your disaster preparedness planning to a different level. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. You'll find all of our guests, link, and information over at disasterpodcast.com in the show notes for this episode. And remember to follow up for episode 2 next week as we continue to learn that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.